Welcome to our first ever Sino-Indo-Techno podcast. Sino-Indo-Techno is a new collaboration with the producers of the Ganbei podcast out of Shanghai, which is hosted by veteran tech lawyer and China watcher Art Dicker. Sino-Indo-Techno will air on a regular basis and will be dedicated to the growing relationship between China and Indonesia within the technology startup space. Please enjoy, and as always, we welcome your feedback.
Welcome back, everyone, to our sixth installment of Indo-Techno. This marks our first collaboration with Art Dicker and the producers of the Ganbei podcast up in Shanghai. Art, privileged to be able to collaborate with you on Sino-Indo-Techno. I've been a fan of your webcasts and podcasts for a long time, and I'm really excited to be able to work with one of the leading voices covering technology in China. As a reminder to our Indonesian listeners, kami akan memberikan transkrip podcast Bahasa Indonesia di situs web kami.
Alan, I'm thrilled to be able to have this joint podcast with you as well and this new series. I've been waiting for a podcast like Indo-Techno to come out covering Indonesia tech, and I'm so thrilled that there's finally one out there and that you're doing it. You have some really great guests, and chief among those, I think, now is Helen on the show. Helen Wong is a partner at Qiming Venture Partners. Qiming is known as one of the leading Chinese venture capital funds, but more and more it's been making investments outside of China and within Southeast Asia. Helen is one of the people leading that effort, so we're thrilled to have Helen on the show today. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you.
I have the pleasure of having worked with Helen for roughly 15 years. For those of you who are not familiar with your great work in venture capital, Helen, could you give us a brief background on yourself and Qiming Ventures?
Sure. I started my career in venture capital in the year 2000 when I joined GGV Capital as a member of the founding team. I was in the Silicon Valley then, and in 2003, we started making more investments in China, and including Alibaba, which was my first investment deal that I worked on in China. And then in 2005, I moved to Shanghai. And I was so involved with Tudou, leading the deal in Tudou, which was one of the leading online video players in China, which subsequently, you know, went public and then merged with Youku and is now part of Alibaba. And then I joined Qiming in 2014. And Qiming is one of the top tier firms, VC firms in China. And among our better known TMT investments, companies like Xiaomi, we also have Meituan. We're also involved with Musical.ly, which is now part of TikTok. And we have also other companies like Mobike. And those are some of the unicorns that we've been involved in.
Great. If you guys don't mind me setting the stage, VC analytics platform Puiquan just released numbers revealing that Hong Kong, China domiciled ASEAN focused VC funds have risen to $2.3 billion in total. But this is still less than one tenth of the $24 billion in ASEAN domiciled, ASEAN focused funds that Puiquan tracks. So it would seem that the China Indo story is still very early days. Qiming was the first major VC to venture into Indonesia and Southeast Asia. Helen, what triggered this initiative?
Sure. I would agree that right now is a very early stage of the China-Indo corridor, so to speak. I think that for Qiming, we were looking at really the development of the mobile internet in China and how it's reached a very mature stage. And as we look for the next growth wave in this industry, we saw that there was a very fast growth in Southeast Asia. And there's also a personal factor here, given that I am from Singapore. So I'm from the Southeast Asia region. And actually, when I started my career with GGV, I started looking at some investments at that time in Singapore as well. But those were very early days for Southeast Asia. And we felt that China had more opportunities. So most of my career since then was in China. And Southeast Asia, I think, only started to take off recently. If you look at the historical growth of the mobile internet, you can see that Southeast Asia probably had only 100 million users, I think around the 2010 timeframe. So before that, I think that Southeast Asia, unfortunately, due to pretty poor bandwidth for the fixed line, never had a lot of PC users, internet users. So we think that the market only got interesting in the last few years. You see the growth of some of the unicorns like Tokopedia, Gojek, and also the flow of more funds into the region, helping the ecosystem grow.
Helen, can you give us a sense of some of the investments you've made to date in Indonesia and also a sense of the pace that you're going to be investing in Indonesia going forward?
Sure. When we started looking at Southeast Asia, obviously Indonesia being the biggest market was the most interesting. So we started, our first investment was Akulaku, which is a team that is focused on the financial sector. And we looked at how underpenetrated the banking sector was in Indonesia, and also how e-commerce was growing very quickly. We thought that Akulaku's positioning in the installment financing area was very interesting. And we thought that the team was quite a good team in terms of learning from China and taking all the work that they've done in fintech algorithms and using that to apply to Southeast Asia market, especially Indonesia, seemed to be working quite well. So that was our first deal in Indonesia. And following that, we've invested in Red Doors, which is in the hospitality space. So they sort of tech-enabled budget hotel chain with properties in Indonesia, but also in other countries like the Philippines and Singapore. And then we also have a very small investment in a company called Mucho, which we actually invested at an angel stage, focused on social e-commerce. So we are starting to expand our investments. And recently we have done another deal, but it's not in Southeast Asia, but not in Indonesia. It's actually, which is focused on Thailand and Malaysia. And regarding pace, I just want to answer your question. So the pace, I think for us is we would like to maintain a steady pace. So every year I do about 2 to 3 deals. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to give ourselves, how should I say, a quota or a certain number that we have to invest in Southeast Asia, but we like to see what are the interesting opportunities and be patient in terms of the amount of money that we've deployed into Southeast Asia.
Thanks for that. Now, Helen, many talk of the clear synergies that exist between China and Indonesia. Some would cite a tight fit between, on one hand, China's 25 years of battle-hardened and time-tested technologies and business models, and on the other hand, Indonesia's large consumer market, its low penetration levels, and its untapped online behaviors. You clearly believe in this kind of symbiosis, but can you peel back this relationship a little further for us? What specific Sino-Indo synergies excite you?
I think Chinese companies have built very interesting business models, first of all, in the recent decade. I think when I started in venture capital, the innovation really came from the US. It came from Silicon Valley. But the last decade, you've seen companies like YY, like PDD, really grow their own innovative models. And even WeChat is a super app that is very unique in the whole world. So I think in terms of these innovative business models and also how the Chinese entrepreneurs, they have a more operationally intensive approach to developing this business models, makes their models very applicable to the rest of the world. If you look at the contrasting with the US apps, you can see that the US apps, they tend to be more focused on product, more product driven, and they tend not to do a lot of localization. So I think that there is a lot that can be learned from Chinese ways of building the internet models, as well as the actual innovations that they've done, and see if there's some of that can be taken to Southeast Asia. And then I would say the other important part is technology, because we've seen how Chinese companies can use technology very effectively, whether it's to match, for example, matching products to consumers, or just matching content to consumers. The level of personalization that can be done with algorithms is very strong, very effective. So I would say those are the things that Chinese have developed very well. And I think it's very exciting when you combine it with Indonesia's large consumer market and as well as the untapped online behaviors. But I do think that the locals also have an advantage in certain business models that require more on-the-ground knowledge and more working with the regulators a little bit more. I think those are business models that would be more relevant for the local teams.
Thanks, Helen. Let's turn a little bit to some of the problems that these companies are, in Indonesia are trying to solve and looking at the model of China and what it went through. A lot of companies succeeded in China years ago because they were able to solve sort of legacy problems in the system. China maybe being perhaps a bit more of a state-dominated economy, where banking, healthcare, other sectors, infrastructure limitations were still dominated by the state and screaming for a better solution. Do you see some of the same patterns now in Indonesia at its stage of development? And if so, what winning companies in the experience of China have a business model that can be applied to Indonesia?
You mentioned state-dominated economy and what was like a very successful model in China. The first thing that comes to mind is not banking or healthcare, but actually media. Because I think China media was controlled. So in the first wave of internet companies in China, it was really about information asymmetry and how a lot of people would go to the internet to search for information and also for entertainment. So when I think about some of our portfolio companies like Zhihu, which is like Quora, like a Q&A platform, it's really driven by people's thirst for knowledge, and they couldn't find it on a traditional media. If I think about Trudeau, which I was an investor, it very much grew because the content that was created by users was a lot more interesting than what I think you could see on the television channels. So I think that was very interesting. And then, yeah, the other sectors came on later. I think you mentioned the banking, healthcare in the last decade or so with innovations. But I think that in Indonesia and Southeast Asia might be different because we see that certain sectors are probably not so open, maybe because they've seen the China story play out. Just thinking about online payments, there's still a lot of barriers to adopting online payment. There's the OTP that you need to do. There's a limit on the transfer amounts that you can have. So in a lot of ways, the experience is not as seamless as using Alipay or WeChat Pay in China. And I think that a lot of it is also the fragmentation of the whole ecosystem. And I think maybe some of the traditional players in banking or healthcare, other areas in Indonesia, being more aware of what can happen to them. And so they are actually jumping in and to prevent that same thing happening in China. Whereas I think in China, I have to give credit to the government because they actually stepped out of the way and just let the private players just grow and develop their business models. So that was a big plus for the China ecosystem.
Helen, picking up on something you referred to earlier, in which verticals or subsectors will Indonesia indeed produce its own champions with their own unique genetic coding to maybe even share with the rest of the world?
It's really hard for me to read into the crystal ball. I would think that in areas like agri-tech and maybe some Muslim-related business models like Sharia finance, maybe that would be areas that we haven't seen, at least in China or in the rest of the world, that could develop unique to Indonesia. I do see that's a possibility, especially having been through the whole wave of China internet. I think that the models really became more innovative when we have a more mature ecosystem and people started to solve problems that were unique to their own country.
Thanks, Helen. We saw the first attempts to move some of the business models that had been proven successful in China to Indonesia, that there were some mixed results. You touched on this a little bit already, but were there specific mistakes that you've seen made in trying to take some of the models from China and apply them to Indonesia?
Yeah, I think I've seen, like you said, mixed results. For example, I think Shopee is very successful, and one could say it's a Taobao model, right? TikTok also just bringing their Musical.ly products or that has worked overseas. In other countries has worked very well in Indonesia as well. And then maybe there are some models like maybe the Alipay or WeChat Pay model, which I would say is also getting wider and wider adoption, but maybe some people say is more cash burning than even the China experience. I think that in some cases, online payment, the push for online payment by the players, maybe it's because it became a proxy war for Tencent and Alibaba, meant that it actually ran ahead of the actual use cases, right? Because e-commerce or even ride-hailing and food delivery have not developed to the same stage that the online payment players hope they would develop to. So you see a lot of subsidies that way above the level you see that even happen in China. And also, I think there's also differences, like, for example, the density of the cities, right? Because in China, you find that it's so dense, so a lot of O2O models work very well, whereas you probably have seen some statistics showing that, you know, Indonesia is not as dense, right? The number of cities with a million people is not as high. So even taking into account, you know, differences in population. And then I think that there are also models that just, I think, struggle a lot. Like, for example, the video sharing, right? The long form video sharing, which is a market that made a lot of money for Chinese VCs, but I think has been tougher in Southeast Asia, given that the whole payment infrastructure, the whole bandwidth infrastructure, and just the availability of good content is not quite available. So, and just buying Hollywood content is very expensive. So I think we've seen iFlix with their struggles recently. In certain areas, you need to be aware of the local market and the differences, and GoPlay might have a better chance than what iFlix did.
Okay. Thanks, Helen. You touched on this one a bit already as well, but maybe just to flush it out a little more on the issue of subsidies and high customer acquisition costs. We've seen that obviously play out in China with Didi and Meituan Dianping and others. You mentioned in Indonesia, there's that tendency as well. Do you see that still today? And do you see that situation learning anything from the China experience?
Yeah, it's a good way to create network effects when you have a cold start in a marketplace model, right? So the use of subsidies, I think, worked well in the beginning. But when the fight between Didi and Friday became like a proxy fight between Tencent and Alibaba, then, you know, it became very expensive. But luckily, they ended the fight with a merger, right? We see the same happen for Mobike and OFO. Unfortunately, we didn't get the merger that we wanted. So if you talk about lessons learned, I think that is probably the biggest lesson, that such subsidy wars can be very costly. If it doesn't result in a merger, then very often you can have a not so positive outcome. The key is always trying to be ahead of other people. I think when you first try subsidies, maybe your competitors don't know that you can use that as a weapon and gain users quickly, then you have an advantage. But once everybody learns that, then it becomes more of a capital game. And I think in an environment where there is going to be less capital, we've seen the SoftBank debacle. And so I think we would see less of subsidy wars in Indonesia. I think at the moment, the user acquisition cost is still not as bad as in China in terms of how fast it's risen. So I would hope that there's not so much of a subsidy war in Indonesia and the reliance on capital. Because ultimately, it's not very good for VCs. It's very diluted for us.
Helen, how do you think about what seems to be a clear difference in quote-unquote digital literacy levels between the two countries? I note that Chinese consumers are, for instance, ravenous consumers of online media, subscriptions, etc., while their Indonesian counterparts, at least currently, are not. Chinese businesses, meanwhile, understand the virtues of B2B software and will pay for some platforms, while SaaS adoption in Indo enterprise seems very low. How does Qiming view this, and how can we take advantage of this?
Yeah, I think there's a few issues that we need to talk about. One is really about just digital literacy difference, right? So basically, Chinese users seem to like to, for example, consume a lot of news and consume a lot of online media in general. But I think the news apps in Indonesia have not done as well. And I think that might be different literacy levels of the two countries. Maybe video took off at the earlier stage, so they gravitate more towards video. So I think that's one issue. And then the other issue is then willingness, right? You mentioned online media subscription. I would say that even in China, for a very long time, users did not want to pay for online media. So at Tudou, we always worried that, well, when are we going to get the users to pay, or when can advertising revenues ever cover our costs? I think that with time, as content became more and more expensive, the platform started to charge for the content. So you saw that in online video, you saw that in online music, as well as online literature. So I think there's definitely over time, there's a percentage of users that are now used to paying for content. And then online gaming definitely has always been a very good revenue generator. But it took time to get users to be used to this. Then the other part is also around regulations, around piracy. So I think in the early days, piracy was very rampant in China. But as the platform started to, you know, pay for the content, to acquire the content, then they started to want to protect their content. So I think then piracy was clamped down. And I still remember how in Shanghai, you can walk around and buy $1 DVD off the street, right? But now you hardly find any of that. So I really think as GDP per capita rises and as people get more used to paying for content, things would change. And then you mentioned another topic, which is regarding B2B software. And even today we talk about this. I think China's ready for SaaS because the current labor cost has gone up. And so productivity is an important issue. But really, you see the big enterprises. We see more SaaS adoption among corporates who are larger and have more money, basically, like, for example, state-owned enterprises. But if you talk about just the average restaurant owner, it may not be very willing to pay for SaaS. But you do see more and more, like, how should I say, openness or awareness of how SaaS can help bring them maybe more customers and increase their productivity. It definitely takes time for both consumers and enterprise to be willing to pay for these online services.
Dipping into geopolitical current events, Helen, will rising Sino-US tensions benefit the Indonesian tech ecosystem? What is Chi Ming's on-the-ground view?
So I think what you see is that with the Sino-US tensions, Alibaba and Tencent as well, to a certain extent, ByteDance, right? I think will increasingly turn their attention to other parts of the world, like Southeast Asia. So I think you saw that with when Alibaba was trying to make an acquisition, I think it was MoneyGram, and the challenges that they faced. So I think that will cause them to say, okay, maybe we want to go to a different part of the world where we will not face such regulatory hurdles. And I think Southeast Asia being geographically closer and also culturally will become more and more important. Recently, we also see some China-Indian tensions. So yeah, I think Southeast Asia may be, especially Indonesia, may be the beneficiary.
Thanks, Helen. One of the bottlenecks to sort of the healthy, sustained growth of the Indonesian tech scene is relatively weak educational inputs. And for example, we might consider engineering talent as one of those. A lot of successful founders as well in Indonesia, much as in China in the early days, are these returnee entrepreneurs. In China, they're referred to as haigui or sea turtles. Do you see that phenomenon continuing in Indonesia or changing?
There are a few issues. One is really about an exposure of the entrepreneur to venture capital. We find that usually the returnee entrepreneurs, same as the early days in China, are exposed to how venture capital works. And so I think they will have an easier time to work with the board and things like that. The other issue you brought up is engineering talent. So that's definitely been something that is lacking in Indonesia, or so I should say in short supply in Indonesia, which forces a lot of the entrepreneurs to go outside of Indonesia. So like maybe to have an Indian tech team or even have a tech team in China or Taiwan. So I think that everybody is focused on how do you be successful, and so you have to be nimble. We see more local entrepreneurs, right? Non-sea turtles. I think definitely in China it happened, and even in Indonesia, I think Tokopedia is very local. So I do see that a local entrepreneur who understands the market very well, who has very good connections and networks that can help him build a business, but there's no reason why they should be passed over for a sea turtle. But I do think as well that we may see more sea turtles getting funded just because they might be more familiar to VCs and with VCs.
And moving on to, you mentioned earlier just a bit, the Alibaba Tencent rivalry in China, which kind of pervades a lot of these subsidy battles and so forth that you mentioned. Do you see this kind of duality being strong in Indonesia? And are these kind of strategic venture capital investors, are they natural partners for institutional venture capital players like yourself?
I think, yes, there's certain sectors that you can see there's a very strong Alibaba Tencent rivalry. So in an online payment, we talked about Tencent backed Gojek and Alibaba. In Indonesia, it's, you know, a bit complicated because they have Dana, and also they also invested in Grab, and Grab has OVO, which we'll see if the OVO Dana merger takes place. But and also in, you could say in e-commerce as well, you have Lazada versus Shopee. And I guess the other question is, are they natural partners for VCs? I would say yes and no. Definitely have worked with both Alibaba and Tencent, and we welcome them, and they bring a lot of very good resources for our startups, portfolio companies. But at the same time, you know, I think we always tell our entrepreneurs that you have to be aware that corporate VCs are very different objectives. Yes. Their main objective is to think about the investment in terms of their corporate agenda. So if that doesn't align with what you're trying to do, then there's going to be challenges.
Helen, going back to a broader brush question, the Southeast Asian VC universe seems to be going through some pretty volatile times. Deal Street Asia, for instance, estimates that $1.3 billion in Southeast Asia dedicated funds was raised in the first 3 months of 2020. While that was down 47% from the fourth quarter of last year, it's still more than triple the value recorded in the same period a year ago. I guess, Helen, I wanted to focus specifically on how valuations have trended in early stage venture investing in Indonesia since the onset of the pandemic. And maybe you can compare it to the degree of compression you've seen in China.
It's an interesting one because I honestly haven't seen too much of a compression of valuation. I think what we see more is sort of polarization of valuation. On one hand, you see the handful of companies that are doing very well, continue to attract more money, and continue to get the high valuations. And then you also see companies that announce they're stopping operations and they are unable to raise any more funding. And I think that what we see more is companies that don't need to raise money, just postponing their fundraising, and companies doing a bit of cost cutting to make sure they have a longer runway. Maybe it's just a matter of time, but I do also think that there's still quite a lot of capital in the system. So it will take a while before valuations really come down.
Thanks, Helen. Going back to an earlier point as well about, we mentioned India recently has become a little more restrictive with regard to the sort of the Chinese internet presence in its market. What's your sense of where Indonesia is going to fall on the spectrum of protectionism, particularly versus openness to foreign players in the market?
With India, you read different things every day. I think that for a while it seemed pretty open, but yeah, recent weeks are months have not been very favorable. But I do think that we always need to be cognizant that there's a risk when you go into a certain country. And I think on the whole, Indonesia, I would say, has been pretty open. You do hear sometimes certain apps being banned or blocked, but the time period is not that long. And you do see that the regulators allow the players to make amendments to their app, and then they are back on the app store. But I do also see certain industries or subsectors, for example, online payment. For a long time, Grab couldn't get a license, and not to say Alipay, right? So I think that there are certain subsectors that they feel they have to protect. I understand every country has their sort of so-called national pillars that they want to protect. But I would also hope that, you know, regulators see at the end of the day, the user is the one that benefits when there's open competition, and when there isn't, usually the end consumer is the one that suffers. So I hope that there will be a open market going forward as well for Indonesia.
Fantastic. Helen, thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this, the first episode of Sino Indo Techno. Art, you'll hopefully be available for another session soon.
Absolutely. I can only hope it'll be as good as this one.
And once again, we thank Helen Wang of Qiming Ventures for joining us in this, the maiden podcast of Sino Indo Techno. And for our Indonesian audience, terima kasih untuk mendengarkan. Sampai jumpa lagi.